Welcome to Dominion Radio on CKDU 88.1. We bring you grassroots news from across the country, focusing on stories and voices silenced by the mainstream media. For more on the topics you hear about tonight, check out the Dominion newspaper at www.dominionpaper.ca. My name's Hillary Lindsay.
And I'm Stuart Neatby.
Tonight, a special episode on police violence in Canada.
On October 14th, Robert Sikowski, a Polish immigrant in the process of immigrating to Kamloops, British Columbia, was shot twice with a taser gun by RCMP officers in the Vancouver International Airport. The video of this incident, which shows a distraught but unarmed Sikowski being tasered by police, has now been seen by millions of viewers after it was posted on YouTube. Here in Halifax, Tony Birdbridge, a 45-year-old man, died 30 hours after police used the taser to subdue him while he was in custody in a Dartmouth jail on November 22nd. Incidents like these have spurred a national debate focused upon the use of tasers, but little attention has been focused upon the patterns that exist of police violence in Canada. Tonight, we examine the issue of police violence, looking specifically at the question of who is policed most within Canada and why. We'll be speaking with Montel, a North End Halifax resident, about racism and policing. We'll also hear from Kim Pate of the Elizabeth Fry Society, who will speak about the criminalization of women with mental health issues. And finally, we'll air an interview with Natercia Coelho, the wife of Gary Freeman, who is facing extradition to the United States after what he describes as defending himself against police brutality. But first, resisting police brutality in Vancouver.
Thomas Mellenfont is a member of the Vancouver-based Anti-Poverty Committee, which is an organization of poor and working people who fight for poor people, their rights, and an end to poverty by any means necessary. The APC is currently planning a protest against police brutality for next week on December 12th. This week, Hillary Lindsay spoke to Thomas about the reasons behind their protest.
The Anti-Poverty Committee is planning an action sometime this month against police brutality, and I'm just wondering if you could tell me what prompted decision to have this action.
Well, what prompted it is the memorial. Right now, it's also the memorial of Frank Paul, which is an Indigenous man that was killed by the Vancouver Police Department some years ago, as well as the fact we've had a spat of recent police shootings and police murders with tasers. And in Chilliwack recently, they did everything but shoot the guy. They beat him with batons and pepper sprayed him and tasered him. There's just been a slew of police deaths recently.
The police deaths that's gotten the most attention is the one that happened in the airport, the taser death recently. Have you found that there's been more awareness given to police brutality in general in Vancouver?
I think there's more awareness now because of the airport incident in Canada-wide, mostly because for, like, the first time in a long time, well, at least Vancouver anyway, it was a white guy that got killed for a change, which is a change for Vancouver's demographic for getting killed. A white guy without mental health issues. His English skills weren't that great, but he wasn't, like, the typical marginalized kind of person, which is why I think a lot of Canada normally wouldn't rally around the death of, say, an Indigenous person or the death of somebody with mental health issues. Finally got the point, well, wow, they're killing us too now.
How does police brutality generally manifest itself in the communities that you work with?
In the communities that we work with, it's mainly targeted at women and Indigenous people, and specifically Indigenous women. Most often, there's all kinds of police violence against sex trade workers. There's all kinds of police violence against... It manifests itself in poor communities in Vancouver, specifically the downtown east side, which is the community we work in. There's a land grab going on right now here, not just for the Indigenous community, but for the non-Indigenous community of the downtown east side, that is losing their housing because of the Olympics. And the people that are on the streets and refusing to go are essentially getting beaten into submission to leave by the police, which is the current motivation of the day. Not that the police need a motivation, but...
A lot of people might have trouble imagining how this happens. Are people just getting picked up off the street? Or what are the circumstances that lead to this brutality?
The circumstances, predominantly, I would argue, in the Indigenous case, are obviously racism. in non-Indigenous cases and in Indigenous cases alike, I would argue that, again, the whole world's going to be here in 2010 for the Olympics, and the downtown east side is this blemish on Vancouver's yuppie skyline, its perfect little city. And rather than invest money in social services to bring the standard up for the downtown east side, they're just essentially trying to run, I would argue, everybody out of town by being as aggressive and brutal as possible in their policing practices with people in this community.
So how is the Anti-Poverty Committee trying to address this?
Initially, there was some thoughts about doing a cop watch program, but with the realization that we're not as large in numbers as we'd like to be, and it's not possible to do that all the time, we're trying to take it more to the political arena, like the police board action that's coming up. We're essentially going in with the line, shut down the police board. We're going to be as confrontational as we can. We're going to let them know that we're not going to tolerate this in our communities anymore. Aside from that, we're developing a program right now because there's a total lack of options for the police can't investigate themselves. So we're trying to develop options for people, and one of those options we're trying to work on right now is develop a program to help victims of police brutality in this neighborhood take the police to small claims court.
And what's the response that you're getting to these tactics?
The response we get, the Anti-Poverty Committee gets in general, is pretty antagonistic. There's a lot of members that live in the neighborhood that have pretty antagonistic relationships with the police. And in general, I think that it's going to be an interesting change of events, like for this action coming up, because I think police brutality is big into the spotlight right now, where it wasn't 6 or 7 months ago. I think where we were the lazy, poor people that just needed to shut up and get a job, and the reason the police were beating us up is because we were doing drugs or whatever, I think that view is getting shed in the public spotlight right now because of the fact that it's becoming more predominant, not just in poor communities and not just in communities with people of color. For the first 15 years of my life, I grew up in the suburbs, and I never, like, imagined that the police would beat people up until I became homeless, and I moved downtown when I was headed downtown when I was young. And, like, over a course of 5 or 6 years and being a squeegee person, I got beaten up under almost every major bridge in every major city in Canada. Like, I think that it takes an eye-opening experience for people, not necessarily maybe getting beaten up by yourself, but I think, again, the fact, like, Robert Dzanski in particular is raising that awareness.
You mentioned, or in your press release, there's a list of people who died in police custody or were killed by the police. Could you talk about any of them? What their particular circumstances or stories were?
I think the appropriate one to bring up now, his memorial is on Thursday, is the day he died, is Frank Paul. He was an Indigenous man that died some years ago. He was an Indigenous man that essentially the Vancouver Police Department left him inebriated, intoxicated, unable to take care of himself in an alleyway at 4 o'clock in the morning on a -2-degree night, deciding that it was safe enough to leave him there. There's an inquiry, a very colonial inquiry going on right now that's being conducted that shows that, like, he wasn't even able to walk inside. Those videos that show him not even being able to walk, the police dragging him out of the holding cells into a paddy wagon to be, like, delivered into this alleyway. In fact, one of the questions that's coming out, surprisingly for a colonial inquiry, is whether he was already dead before they brought him outside. And, again, I think it boils down specifically in this case to a race issue. Like, if this was a white guy, I don't think they would have just dragged him out and left him in the alleyway. But the police have this whole racist mentality where it's just like, yep, just another drunk Indigenous guy. We can just leave him in the lane, and, you know, they're used to this kind of thing. They're used to the cold. It's okay. We can leave him there, and he'll be fine. And it's like, well, yep, he died a couple hours later, you know what I mean? He died because the police have this, like, racist framework in their head where they think it's okay to treat people that aren't white that way.
That was Thomas Malafont, member of the Vancouver-based Anti-Poverty Committee, speaking with Hillary Lindsay about police brutality.
Stand clear, done, man, I talk. You can't stand where I stand, you can't walk where I walk. Watch out, we run New York. Policeman come, we bust him out the park. I know this for a fact, you don't like how I act. You claim I'm selling crack, but you be doing that. I'd rather say see ya, cause I would never be ya. Be a officer, you wicked overseer. Get pucks and be a savior. First show a little respect. Change your behavior. Change your attitude. Change your plan. There could never really be justice.
next step, we'll be looking more closely at youth violence in Halifax and how it is rooted in a history of racism, segregation, and classism perpetuated by the Nova Scotian government and the city police. Angela Day speaks with Montel, a North End community member, about the antagonization of marginalized communities and the perpetuation of the cycle of violence.
In light of all the focus on violence in the North End of Halifax lately, especially in terms of the youth here, can you speak to any of the root causes that may be behind this trend?
Well, I feel that it's a lot has to do with the government not putting programs installed that are going to be consecutive to the youth in the community, things that are going to be advanced to the youth in the community. They also neglect to look at the fact that, you know, we're coming from an urban community, that a diversity of things go on, you know. Some people are growing up with parents that are suffering from drug addiction. Some people are bringing themselves up. You know, some people are suffering from abuse, substance abuse, a whole variety of things. And I feel that they neglect to look at the causes of why people act the way they act. They had to resort to other means to financially take care of them and their families. So they have to resort to doing crime. And it's not the fact that people want to do it, it's the fact that people have to survive. And living off of welfare or living off of a minimum wage is not going to feed a family of five, you know? So, you know, sometimes people have to do things that they regret doing, but they have to do it to put food on the table. You know, no one wants to live off of Kraft dinner, hot dogs, or bologna. You know, life of the cost of living is a good $1,000 a month. You know, a lot of people ain't even receiving that, you know? A welfare check with kids will only last a week after they grocery their house, you know? So if a child's hungry after that, what is a child or a parent supposed to do? You know, if you have hungry children and adults in a house, what happens? You know, it becomes dysfunctional. The government can send one of their employees on a $10,000 training for a four-hour seminar when that $10,000 could go into a community for a consecutive program. But instead, no, they'll put the child out of school, know that they'll go to the streets and end up being either dead or incarcerated all their life. I blame the government and, you know, I blame the police because the police force, I feel that they don't do nothing but antagonize and use their power to their means and manipulate and use excessive force, and they're very immature. You know, they don't relate to the children because they don't understand the children. You know, all they see, the children and the adults, I should say, of the community as trouble. And I don't understand why society ain't looking at the fact that, you know, we're in a crisis in Halifax and we need someone to look into the fact that, hey, people are out there looking for opportunities and looking for answers, but nothing's coming to us. So how do we react? It's like a hungry bunch of wolves, you know? How would they react, you know?
And you mentioned that the police often respond violently. Can you elaborate on that a little bit and how that affects the situation of youth in the community?
Well, if you got a youth that is already suffering from multiple different angers or issues and you have an officer that feels like provoking or instigating someone, come by and antagonize someone and they react in an aggressive manner or say things that they might regret, then the cop gets his advantages by arresting or being unprofessional and engaging in ignorant dispute. And their officers and co-workers support them when they step out of their professionalism. None of them ever go to the mature fact of saying, oh, come on now, we're going out our job limitations, or just, you know, let's just go. You know, it's they engage on it too. Well, you know, they feel that it's a thrill, or, you know, they get a power rush out of it. So just because someone's in an area that has a high activity of drugs, alcohol, substance abuses, abuse and whatever, that don't give anybody the right to come in and to manipulate or harass or emotionally, physically abuse someone. And that's what they're doing. They're emotionally, physically, and verbally abusing the members of the community. And that's what they're doing. And a person could be coming out of a situation that's been verbally, emotionally, physically abused, and they're setting them back in that abuse again. So actually, someone could be in the process of healing, but they're not able to heal because they have an authority figure coming here and abusing their power. What is one to do when they are treated, you know, as, you know, a person? If you treat a dog bad, it's going to attack one day, you know. Just because a cop is a cop, that don't mean they have the right to say anything to you that they want. We have charters, and we are Canadians, you know, and we have rights, human rights. And, you know, when you mistreat someone, someone's going to speak about their mistreatment. They don't get that. You know, they still abuse their power.
Also, do you think then that the police, when they react with violence in this way, that they're operating with impunity? So do you think that they're ever being held accountable for their actions in this community?
No, I don't. I believe that they're not reprimanded for what they do. I even took steps to make them be accountable for their actions towards me and things that I witnessed over the last years of being an activist and being on the role of trying to make police be more professional and be professional. But, you know, it's a situation between police doing their job and police feeling that, okay, this is this community, so this is their treatment, you know? So, you know, that's my outlook on them.
That was Mantel from Halifax speaking with Angela Day about the underreported systematic violence in Halifax.
Kim Pate is the executive director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, which is a federation of 26 local community-based service providers who work with and on behalf of marginalized, victimized, criminalized, and imprisoned women. She recently spoke about the criminalization of women with mental health issues at a conference in Halifax and challenged the federal government's new proposed omnibus bill. She urges Canadians to call for more social services, healthcare, and education and employment options, rather than the implementation of the government's U.S.-style plan to drain more resources in favor of guns and longer prison terms. And now here's an abridged excerpt of the talk Kim Pate gave in Halifax on November 1st.
The history of colonization is very much linked to the issues we talk about when we talk about the links in terms of the criminalization of women and the massively increasing numbers of women inside. So that's the current reality of far too many women, and I'll talk a bit more about that. It's also important that you pick the issue of criminalization, or that you asked me to talk about this, the criminalization of women with mental health issues, because more than 15 years ago, it was this region, it was a visit to this region, it was a call to account based on a visit that I made to the segregation area in the prison for women in Kingston that made us identify at the national level the criminalization of women with mental health issues as a major priority. Because what happened is I had a call from some folks in Newfoundland about the more resources being cut there. Not a big surprise, it's where we saw the first economic downturn. And when we heard about the call, it just happened to coincide with the next day I was going to be in prison for women. And when I went into the segregation area, I was shocked to realize that the majority of the women who were in there were women who had mental health issues and or intellectual disabilities. And even more shocking was they were almost half of the women from this region, and most of them were from Newfoundland at the time. That's not true anymore, but it was at the time. So it didn't take a lot of thinking to realize how this was linked to the cuts that were happening to social services, to health care, and even to education, because as we see fewer opportunities for those who are most marginalized, the only systems that can't turn people away, the only systems that can't say our beds are full, the only systems that can't say, sorry, our waiting list is too long, is the criminal justice system, and the prison system in particular. And when I went to Newfoundland, the man who was in charge of the jail there, what he said was, you may have heard on the news today that they're closing another wing of the Waterford, and those of you who know Newfoundland know the Waterford is the psychiatric hospital. He said, they're closing it. I said, my dear, they may as well take a truck over there, load those women up, and bring it over here, because this is where they're going to end up. All the mental health workers we met with recognized that what was really happening was, as those resources were being cut, those women would literally be dumped into the streets, and that to survive being in the streets, they might do things that could cause them to be criminalized. They might purposely do things that cause them to be criminalized because they may be told that that's the only place they could ensure they had a bed to sleep in, food to eat, and be out from the elements. So they saw that. Unfortunately, all too often, I get them from police officers, I get them from provincial corrections people, I get them from federal corrections people, and of course I get them from women who are serving beside their sisters, or and when I worked with men and with youth, I'd get them from them as well, saying, look, these are people we know should not be in here. They should not be in jail. There's nothing we can do. One of the things that many people have said is, you know, can you talk to the mental health system? So we did. We started talking to the mental health system. And what we found is mental health workers who have spent their lifetimes, life work has been trying to assist people who have mental health issues, or challenges, addiction issues, all of those sorts of areas.